recording for birthday.
Okay, cats, I'll sit.
Get a pin for birthday?
I'm celebrating.
Everybody sit down. Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Sorry about the slippage in our punctuality program. This is the last time this is going to happen. And I do appreciate the committee members getting here on time. So we will make sure we start on time next time. Okay, we are going to start today by opening a work session for possible bill introduction. Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, we have five LCs that we requested for on behalf of the committee for introduction for the session. And there we have a list there in front of you, and those are all available on the S drive in detail.
Okay. And as we always point out before our introductions, this does not imply committee support or opposition to the particular bills. Maybe you could just read the draft numbers, Paul, and the relating clause.
Okay. The bills are LC 1665, which is relating to taxation of centrally assessed property, LC 3481, which is relating to facilities districts and metropolitan service districts, and this is actually replacing another bill that you have in the committee. LC 3596 is relating to state finance and the rainy day fund. 3597 is a constitutional amendment relating to the Oregon rainy day fund. And LC 3598 is a general state finance bill.
Okay. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt as committee bills LC 1665, dated 1-18-11, LC 3481, dated 2-9-11, LC 3596, dated 2-8-11, LC 3597, dated 2-8-11, and LC 3598, dated 2-8-11.
Senator Morris has moved the aforementioned LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will close the work session, and we will open an informational meeting on tax compliance and administrative overview.
Madam Chair, we've asked Department of Revenue Director Elizabeth Harchenko to brief the committee on the overview of Oregon Tax Administration. I think she's done this at least the last three sessions, I think, gone through and give you some background. You have a number of bills that are specifically related to that, so this is an overview before you proceed into those bills.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I'm going to go over three things today. I'd really like to focus where you'd like me to focus. Because I can talk for days about what we do at the Department of Revenue. I'm going to remind you of the work that over the years the legislature has given the department to do. I believe that all of you have a great deal of familiarity with that because you've been on revenue committees in the past. I'm going to share with you the results of the 2009-11 projects that we were given, or at least the high-profile projects, and then talk to you a bit about where we're going in the future. I'd appreciate it if you have questions, if you just stop me and ask. But I will barrel on if I don't hear an interruption.
Barrel away.
Okay. So, let's see here. Okay, Chris, what do I do now? I'm pushing an arrow and it's not happening.
Chris, feel free to stay there if you want to do that.
Okay, so. Okay, all right, super. Thank you. I'm still technologically impaired after all these years. Okay, so the primary programs that the Department of Revenue is responsible for are the income taxes, both the individual income tax and corporate tax. The property tax system, we supervise and support the work that takes place in community that's conducted by the county assessors and tax collectors, and the cigarette and other tobacco taxes. We, as you know, administer many other taxes and programs, and I've got a slide at the end of the deck with that list, but I'd like to focus today on these three program areas. Just as a quick reminder, the work that the department does, it brings in the lion's share of your general fund. This pie chart comes from the current biennium's latest forecast. And as you can see, the personal income tax is by far the largest portion of the revenue that makes up the general fund. Corporate tax is the next largest. Tobacco tax, much of the tobacco tax money is dedicated to the health plan or other places, and so this is the portion that goes into your general fund. And then lottery and other sources make up the last 8%. We do collect some of the other, and that would include things such as inheritance tax, court fines and assessments, and amusement device tax. The income tax programs, what I'm trying to give you here is a quick visual of the primary blocks of work that we do for you in the income tax programs. We begin because we have every part of the responsibility for these taxes with the information and support that taxpayers need in order to file and report, calculate their tax correctly, and do what they need to do when they need to do it. We process returns and payments, correspondence. We obviously bank funds. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we're responsible for assuring compliance, and to do that, we audit returns that are filed to assure that the tax has been calculated correctly. We collect delinquent tax debt, and we assure that people who are supposed to be filing, or businesses or corporations that are supposed to be filing, are doing so. The overall work in the income tax programs takes up about half of our resources in terms of people because of the processing on banking and other activities related to support for taxpayers. You can see, again, this is the slice of the general fund that is coming in through the work that we do on the income tax programs. The ways that we provide assistance in education include forms and publications, the internet, telephone, in-office visits by taxpayers. We're expecting about 1.8 million tax returns this year. We're hoping to have more than 60% electronically filed. Last year, I think we just hit 60% by the time we got through the whole of filing. And the data I saw on Friday indicated we're past 200,000 returns already so far for this filing season. We, in addition to current year returns, we receive past year's returns and amended returns that we process.
We heard earlier that there's been an increasing trend toward extensions. What does that do? How much are you noticing that? What percentage do you think will have extensions, and what implications does that have for how your department works and in terms of our revenue stream?
Well, Senator Burdick, I don't have data off the top of my head, but Deborah's taking notes. So we'll get you some data on experience with extensions. If people file an extension for federal purposes, they're automatically entitled to extend for Oregon. And so we kind of don't know about the extensions until the extended returns come in. Taxpayers are obligated to estimate as best they can what their liability will be for the year and pay that by April 15th, even if the return isn't going to come in until later. I know that for this past fall, we geared up as we normally would for a significant amount of extended returns, and the processing manager said it was kind of a non-event. So I don't know that we're seeing a significant additional amount of extended returns. The electronic filing system makes processing much, much easier whenever returns come in. But we'll get some data to tell you whether we're seeing more tax returns actually come in October. I know that businesses, especially really large businesses, sometimes have to extend simply because closing the books, filing in other states if they have to file in other states, preparing their federal return, which of course has to be done before they can do their Oregon return, would affect a decision about whether to extend and file a little bit late.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Telford.
Thank you. You mentioned that we're kind of ahead with 200,000 returns being filed. We're kind of ahead a little bit from prior years. So the question I have, since filing date isn't until today, if you have a long form, meaning itemized deductions, my assumption then would be these are all 40, you know, A's or something, you know, without any itemized deduction, since federally you can't file before today, number one, and number two, Oregon Department of Revenue, with your 40, you have to have attached a copy of the first two pages of the 1040.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we had our e-file open a couple of weeks back, and I'm not sure that we're ahead. I just know that returns are coming in. And we're past 200,000. As I looked at the data, there's a much higher proportion of electronically filed returns. It may be that those returns that are coming through are returns that don't have the kinds of issues that the IRS needed people to wait on, things that were affected by the federal legislation that was passed in December, fairly, you know, straightforward returns that just didn't have any of those items and where people could go ahead and file. So we have a pretty high proportion early of e-filed returns. The paper tends to come in later. But I can sure ask, Deborah to get a little more detail for you on sort of what the season looks like.
A follow-up then. Yes, because you can't file your Oregon until your federal's done unless you're not itemizing. And since you can't do a federal tax return until today at the earliest, my question is, of those 200,000 or whatever, how many of them were incorrectly filed because they do have itemized deductions or something on them?
Well, we've...
I know you don't have that information.
Well, I know,
I'm just kind of looking...
Yeah, we'll get some more data for you, but I do know from the data that I see that... that we're not suspending significant numbers of electronic returns, and they may be the kinds of returns that simply don't have the issues that were affected by the federal legislation that was not passed till December. I think that the folks who enable electronic filing are going ahead and receiving returns. So we'll get some more information about filing and get that detail back to you about how that's all working. But I do know that we're filing season is well underway and we're getting returns of all types. Paper, the 2D type that we get that's computer repaired with the barcode and then electronically filed, both on the old platform and the new platform that the IRS are maintaining. So this is just to try to give you a picture of the way in which the resources that come in for the individual income tax come in. Income tax withholding is, you know, employees letting their employers know that they need to have withholding coming out of their wages, and the employers remit that those dollars on a payroll-by-payroll basis, payroll period-by-payroll period. Quarterly estimated payments are due for certain types of income, and then we get about 13% coming with paid returns. The enforcement work that we do brings in about 2% of the big lump of dollars that are received. But when you look at what the size 2% of $11 billion is still a pretty significant amount of money. But we try to remember this in making sure that we're focusing an appropriate amount of resource on the voluntary system and making sure that employees and employers know what they need to do in order for the withholding system to work, that people are able to easily file and report their on their quarterly basis and and that they can make their, they can calculate and make their payments as they file their returns each year. I'm going to shift now from the income tax to the property tax. We are a partner in administration of the property tax. Unlike the income taxes, where the department is responsible for every step of the process and interaction with taxpayers, the department supports much of what goes on at the county level. We provide services for one of two reasons. Either that statewide it's more efficient for us to do work that has to be done the same across the whole state, or we have the ability to provide a higher degree of technical ability to an issue when some counties just don't have the resources to be able to support, for example, having an industrial property appraiser on the staff or a cartographer on the staff. So the valuation work we do is all centrally assessed businesses. So that would be communications, transportation, energy companies. That role is for 2010 was about $18.5 billion of value that was reported then out to the counties, allocated out to the counties for determination of the amount of tax that those businesses would pay. The industrial property valuation function is one that we have responsibility for industrial sites where the improvements are worth at least $1 million in real market value. And that role for 2010 was about $16.1 billion of value, also then reported back to the assessors for determination of the tax and the tax collectors for collection of the tax. The industrial property tax role includes electronics companies, wood products, food processing, manufacturing, and other kinds of fairly complex properties. The counties are responsible for the land values for those properties. And then the counties, of course, handle all residential property, commercial property, recreational property, and everything else other than the industrial and utility roles. The mapping function that we have is two-part. We establish statewide standards for property tax maps so that the accounts that are being maintained for every property owner have an accurate description of the land and the improvements on those properties. We do the mapping for 14 counties on contract because their resources are small enough that it's not efficient for them to try to have a cartographer on their staff. And so we maintain their maps and make sure that they're up to date as changes are made. The oversight function is grows out of the fact that the Oregon Constitution requires a uniform system, and we establish standards for consistency and uniformity in county tax administration for everything from how you determine whether properties are eligible for the over 100 different property tax exemptions that are available to standards for valuation, how information needs to be maintained in the assessor's records, and what the tax statement looks like. We also provide support for the counties as they have questions or problems with personal property taxation, special purpose properties that they may not have the expertise to value, and so forth. And then with respect to forest land, our role is to determine on a statewide basis the value of the different land categories. There are a variety of different forest land valuation categories that are based upon the productivity of the land for growing trees. And we determine those values at the state level and certify those out, and the counties use those as they are doing the property tax bills for those property owners. And you can see where the resources that are generated by the property tax system go. And that's a biennial number. This is a new slide for us, and it helps, I think, to illustrate the relative contribution between the property tax and the income tax, so local funding and state funding, for the big primary service blocks that the state and local government deliver to citizens. We clearly have in the department a partnership in helping the counties to administer the property tax, and then of course we collect the income tax. The education block includes everything: K-12 education service districts, community college, higher education, and you can see there's quite a big partnership there between the state and the local governments. Human services is just what we talk about at the state level: healthcare, food stamps, senior services, children's services, mental health services, public safety, police, adult and juvenile corrections, and the courts. And then the other, everything from transportation and land use to planning and economic and community development. And as you can see, the property tax brings in just about as much as the income tax to help fund services for Oregonians. I'm going to move to the tobacco taxes now. Similarly to the income tax programs, we're responsible for the entire administration. So we do the same things. We involve in making sure that those who are responsible to collect and remit these taxes know how to do that, when they're due, how to remit them, and how to report. We collect and bank those funds. The big difference for a cigarette is that we sell stamps that are affixed then to the cigarette tax packs as evidence that the tax on the cigarettes themselves have been paid before they go into circulation and sale at the retail level. The auditing function is focused more on the other tobacco products tax program, where distributors don't have any indicator that the tax has been paid that's attached to the packaging, and so they have to file a return and report distribution of the products and then the calculation of the tax. And then we also have an inspection function where we make sure that products that are being sold at retail in the state have had the tax paid. And as you can see, there's quite a broad range of recipients of the cigarette and tobacco tax revenues. We also have agreements with the Oregon tribes, not every single one of them, I think, maybe all but one or two, for refunds of cigarette taxes that are paid on cigarettes that if they sell cigarettes to their members. And this allows for avoidance of a compliance problem throughout the state, and the arrangements, some of these arrangements go back into the 60s of tribes selling taxed cigarettes and then the department rebating a portion of the or rebating the tax back to the tribe for those cigarettes that are not to be taxed because they're being sold to tribal members. We're currently beginning to talk with a couple of tribes about a similar refund process for taxes paid on other tobacco products as they move into distribution of those products. Okay, so this is a high-level report of the work that you gave us to do for the current biennium. You all, I know, are very familiar with the amnesty program. Through December 31, we had banked a little over $47 million attributable to the amnesty program. We're still receiving payments. The pay plans are good through the end of May, and so there should be some additional revenue coming in there. I think the lion's share of it has clearly come in. We had a policy option package that gave us about 35 positions to enhance both taxpayer self-sufficiency with development of some new applications so that taxpayers could do more for themselves without having to call us on the phone or write us about their accounts, and also some enforcement both in the filing enforcement area, withholding and collections. we had estimated that we would generate an additional $19.3 million for the biennium, and I'm very pleased to report that the staff has outdone itself and already generated over $36 million of additional.
And is that net after the cost of the new employees has been subtracted?
This is gross to gross. The cost of the package was $5.1 million.
So basically, we netted about $31 million.
Yes, okay. So far.
Good.
Revenue speed up was an effort that we undertook as it became clear that the economy was starting to sink. Just reassigning some of our current staff to work that would generate revenue more quickly into this biennium. Our commitment was $20.6 million. At the end of December, we were almost there. We did reach our $20.6 million commitment in January and have shifted those staff back to their other work. The BOOST program was one that was enacted by the legislature in February 2010. It dedicates revenues from an audit package that was, I think, 25 or 26 staff to a grant and loan program that's administered by the Business Oregon. And we knew that it would be a backloaded in terms of the revenues coming in because we needed to hire people, train them, and get them out working. Our estimate was that through December 31, we should have seen about $1.5 million. So we're ahead of schedule there and on track to produce the revenue that we had committed.
So where did the $7.5 million come from then?
The $7.5 million was our estimate for the full biennium through June 30. And
you expect to make that?
Yes, we will, because we didn't start working. People came in the door April 1. Mm-hmm. Takes a couple months to train. So, and then they had to get out in the field and start doing some audits.
And how much did that program cost?
Oh, where's my boost? I'm going to have to ask Deborah to get you back to you on that one because I don't have it off the top of my head.
Was it $2 million?
If someone knowledgeable is saying $2 million, it was $2 million.
$3 million.
I just can't remember.
I'm not good
at
ever taking $3 million.
So,
she's
but it was a couple of audit teams working in the individual and business areas.
So if it was around $3 million, then we'll expect to see a net of about $7.5 million.
Right, net $7.5 was what was supposed.
I mean,
$4.5 million. Well, actually, Madam Chair, $7.5 million was the commitment that we made to go into the Boost Fund, and the auditors were paid for out of the amnesty money. So you had, you may remember during the February session, we had reported already that we were well past the amnesty target, and the legislature appropriated funds out of the amnesty fund to pay for that audit package and the revenues that are going into the Boost Fund.
Right, and I think it'd be helpful when we continue to talk about these if we make it clear what the net is
okay.
on all these, because all of them have a cost.
Okay.
And so we want to make sure we keep a real clear, transparent look at the cost benefit.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you'd like us to, we can redo this slide and give you an indication of cost and net.
That'd be great. Senator House.
Yes, yeah, you may have said this, but the $47 million raised through 12/31/10, can you estimate how much it will be with when these payment plans play out the rest of this year, particularly if we do that extension to your ballpark?
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Hess, the one thing that we can't know is whether people will follow through with pay plans. So we know how many dollars are still scheduled, and we can get that detail to you. But all kinds of things can happen to people that can cause them to abandon pay plans. And so we will know what is scheduled, but really we can only tell you as money comes in what's coming in. But my memory is it's a relatively small remaining amount that's scheduled. And we've had the same question from the other end of the building. How much is going to come in?
Yeah.
Can't know that because people people in the amnesty project, there are a number of hurdles that the taxpayer has to jump over to get the full benefit of the amnesty, which was the waiver of penalty and half the interest. And if at any point they fall down, then they lose the deal. So we're constantly kind of watching and seeing whether people are going to be able to make it. And I know we've suggested to you that you might want to give us a little flexibility if somebody gets right almost up to the finish line and just needs a little bit of grace so that we can provide that.
Thank you.
Any, then the final package was other agency accounts. We collect delinquent debt that's owed to over 280 other state and local entities. The policy option package itself cost $1.5 million, and the gross revenue that was projected was about $9 million. It was, I think, 13 limited duration positions that we were given in order to boost our production. Our single largest customer in other agency accounts is the court system. Okay, I want to spend a little time talking to you about where we're going. So, Senator Burdick, cut me off when you need to cut me off. We have been working in the agency for several years on developing strategic direction. And I reported to you 2 years ago that we had done some work looking at what our vision for the department was, that we wanted to be a model of 21st century tax administration. We knew we had a lot of work to do in order to achieve that vision. And we had identified seven areas where we needed to work: people, processes, using information for high-quality results, customer focus, public confidence, compliance, and partnerships. And we sort of stalled because of the crash in the economy and the need to focus on revenue generation, but we've picked up again and done some work to try to really focus toward the future. So we took all of that work that we had done and synthesized into a very short statement of our strategic business purpose, which applies to all the work that we do, and that is to have healthy revenue systems that are trusted, timely, and simple, or as simple as possible, and that really spans all of the work that the legislature has given us to do over the years. We've set some very high-level targets for ourselves. These are, if we were perfect, in a perfect world, 100% of taxes that are due under the tax programs would be paid voluntarily. There would be 100% accuracy in our work as well as the work that taxpayers have to carry on their own, and that we would double our value or our efficiency, or both, over time to go from where we are today to where we want to be. We've identified four big strategy areas that we want to work in. The mission of the department is to make tax systems work to fund the services that preserve and enhance the quality of life for citizens, and we are attentive to both of those components. This true north of strategic business purpose, healthy revenue systems, is going to help us as an organization to make our decisions. As we are confronted with a choice, a decision, a fork in the road, we can ask ourselves, which choice will help us move toward true north? Which choice will help us to realize and contribute to healthy revenue systems? And those are the choices that we'll make. Thus, in the strategy areas, these are really very high level, and we're continuing to get more concrete as we move down and flesh out those strategies. But the basically what we're trying to do as we look at compliance as a strategic component of our work, we want to make it easy for people to comply. As you remember from the voluntary compliance slide, the more people who are able to, willing to, and wanting to comply, the better, the easier it is to administer a program. We want to be able to intervene as soon as possible to correct behavior that isn't correct and to verify to the maximum extent we can that that the returns or other information that's coming in is accurate. We know that we have to focus on taxpayers and provide the right services to them so that they're able to do what they need to do under the law and to do that in a simple and timely way. We know that our people are the critical ingredient for accomplishing any of this and that we need to be sure that they have the best tools available to do their work, both the information that we have available to us, automated tools, and good business processes. And then partnerships are also a key to our ability to be successful. The most obvious one is in the property tax system because of the relationship we have with the counties in joint administration of that system. But we have many, many partnerships between ourselves and other state agencies, between revenue departments in other states with the Internal Revenue Service, and then at the local level as well, and in the private sector. And we need to be sure that we're leveraging those for our absolute maximum benefit in achieving healthy revenue systems. We've been working on strategic objectives for each of these big strategy areas, and we're beginning to adopt operating objectives that get down to more concrete, how are we going to get this done? And we are already working for on some projects using rapid process improvement to look at our audit selection processes. We're looking at some of the collection processes. We are going to do a project inside the processing center to see what we can do to make that a more efficient and economical work area, especially as the electronic filing continues to grow and we need to make sure that we don't run that system as if it was just an extension of paper. We've done a project in the property tax area to help us with the processing of industrial returns that come in every year. And we're actively looking, I would say, for the very next best thing to work on. Over the years, as we have worked with the legislature on tools, new tax programs, some of the things that we've done together and worked on have been, I believe this will be a good thing to do. We think that would be a good thing to do. We haven't really tested ourselves with asking about having good data on which to base those judgments. We have a tremendous foundation that was laid when the department did the compliance report that we presented a couple of years ago, and we're trying to continue that discipline of gathering information, trying to learn what it's telling us about what is and how it can inform decisions that we make about what we're going to do in the future. And so the looking really actively for the very next best case to audit, the very next best debt to collect, or the best tool to develop next is going to be, I think, a mantra in the agency as we try to focus the resources that we have so that they are giving you back the maximum return on the investment that you make in us. The governor has issued, as you know, his recommended budget. We had been holding vacant and expected to lose quite a few positions as a result of the June allotment reductions. He's recommended that about 33 of those positions be restored. And so I think that looking at the overall resources that he's recommending, we'll be able to manage to move toward our true north, our healthy revenue systems, and keep most of the lights on that we're working on today. We're also working very hard to look at how we would replace, over time, the automated systems that we rely on today. Many of them are firmly anchored in technology that is obsolete. And although they are still working like a good old car, they're cars that kind of run on gas before, let's see, before ethanol, and they do need, they are going to need to be replaced. So we have to do that in a thoughtful, orderly, careful way, and we are planning that along with business process change that doesn't really require change in the systems necessarily, but the changes in the way we think about our work. The last slide I have is, this is some of the rest of the work that you have given us to do. And they, many of these programs are dedicated to very specific, to support very specific activities, as I know you realize. And that's what I have. So I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you have of me.
Thank you. It's a good overview. Are there questions from the committee? Drinking violets today. Okay. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, Elizabeth.
Okay. We'll get the data that you've asked for back to you through Paul or Chris.
Great.
And if there's ever anything we can do for you, as you know, just call on us.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
Chair.
Okay, we will close the informational meeting and open a work session. And change staff here. So we will open a work session at this time on Senate Bill 301. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In your packet for Senate Bill 301, you have a dash 2 amendment, and you have the paperwork associated with that. There's a preliminary SMS. There's a revenue impact, which has the numbers that were roughly the numbers that were discussed last time, and then a fiscal impact, which is a no impact. But the dash 2, what it does is the bill as drafted reconnects to everything. The dash 2 prevents a reconnect for bonus depreciation and Section 179 expensing. And so the revenue impact, as discussed last time, in 09-11 it's $15.4 million, and then 11-13 it's minus $1.5 million. And most of that impact is related to the deduction for qualified higher education expenses, the so-called tuition expenses. And that's about $10 million. And then the variety of other provisions make up the remainder of the revenue impact.
But if we had connected to the other provisions, the revenue impact would have been substantial, correct? About around $65 million?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Just a reminder to the committee that we did disconnect from those two that were remaining disconnected from here. That policy decision was made in 2009. And the bill itself does connect us to the tuition deduction, which has been in effect for a number of years at the federal level, and as I recall, it's going out. It gets sunsetted after 2011. Is that correct, Chris? So this is something that we're signing up for 2010 only. And I might just remind the audience that this, all of the changes, all the connection issues dealt with in Senate Bill 301 apply only to the 2010 tax year, correct? The calendar year.
Correct. The reconnect is for the question is tax year 2010.
Correct. And so there will be legislation coming down the pike a little bit later that will discuss the connect issues for the 2011 tax year, but those issues are not being considered here. The reason for that being that we need to operate, we need to get something out of here pretty quickly so that the poor taxpayers out there who are still scratching their heads about what Congress did and how much of it the state is going to pick up that they'll be able to file tax returns that actually comply with the law once we tell them what the law is. So that's what we have before us. The Dash 2 amendment, as Chris said, just excludes the connection for those two depreciation measures, business depreciation. Are there any questions? Senator Telfer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. While I'm disappointed that we're not getting the bonus depreciation and Section 179 depreciation, which I do think would create jobs, I welcome this reconnection. But because time is of the essence, is there a reason we can't make it an emergency clause and it's 91 days past sine die?
It's a tax issue, and that's we're not allowed to a tax administration issue. We're not allowed to have an emergency clause.
Okay.
But we are assured by the Department of Revenue that that the message will go out to taxpayers that they can comply with this and that they won't do themselves any harm by complying with it, even though it doesn't technically go into effect.
Follow
until
up.
91 days after.
Because that does push us up against the extension time frame for anybody wanting to hold off filing instead of filing an amendment. Pushes us into October, so.
Correct. But they don't, people don't need to file an extension simply because of this bill. They can go ahead and apparently this has happened in the past and it's worked out smoothly where they can just take what we've done here, file accordingly, and no harm comes to them.
So clarification, we don't have to wait until it takes effect. We can file now, assuming that or knowing that this will become effective 30 or 91 days past signing.
Correct. Deborah, do you want to step that? And address that a little more?
No.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. The choices that we have are not the best because of the fact that it is not effective until 91 days after adjournment. However, it would not be administratively efficient or smart for us to adjust returns that come in before the effective date and then have to turn around and readjust them after the law takes effect. So our position is that if this measure were to make it through both houses and be signed by the governor, we would presume that there would not be petitions circulated to put it on the ballot and that it would actually go into effect 90 days after sine die. We would process returns with that understanding. And then if for some reason it actually never did go into effect, we would have the job of going back to those returns and making adjustments. So,
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Deborah, does that mean as a CPA preparing tax returns, I can't do something that isn't lawful? So I'm kind of in a bind here, so I'm hoping to get some sort of direction from the department that allows us to do something that we know is not law when we're doing it.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we have advised on our website that there are two options. One is to wait until the legislature has acted and the law takes effect to file the returns. The second option was to file under current law, and then if the legislature changes and does the connection as it is proposed in this bill, to amend.
Right.
Personally, I would say that there is a third option, and if I were in practice, this is probably what I would do, which is to file the return. If this is enacted, and I know it's going to take effect 90 days later, file the return and disclose on the return the position that I've taken, that it reflects Senate Bill 301 when it will become law. I have then, in my opinion, complied with the ethical standards that require me to file an accurate return by disclosing that. Now, some may have different opinions as to whether that actually is complying with your ethical standards, but that is another option. So for those that just don't want to wait until it actually takes effect, I would say, again, amend or file with disclosure. We are not going to adjust returns that come into us that reflect the position of Senate Bill 301 if you have passed this and if it's been signed by the governor. That would just not make good business sense for us. Your question is to whether you ethically can sign it. and say that it's correct. And I wonder if disclosing your position might not be one way to comply with that.
Well, I would just hope that maybe the OSCPA would give us some guidance, maybe even the Board of Accountancy, as to what we're supposed to do here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And wait, before you go, Deborah, it's unusual to have Congress act this late on something so substantive. So it's not a really common situation, although it did happen just 2 years ago.
More common than we'd like.
Right, more common than we'd like. But we do have some precedent for this. And is this, the way you described it, is that the way it's worked in the past?
Madam Chair, it has become more commonplace for Congress to act later and later with retroactive implications for taxpayers. Prior to, I believe, 97, we had an ongoing connection. Every session, we would bring you a bill that moved the connection date ahead, because at that time we did not have automatic conformity. So prior to 97, it was very standard practice for accountants to make modifications on the Oregon return to adjust for account for differences in the law, and then come back and amend those returns later once you had done the connection. So it's not unheard of, but having gotten used to some automatic conformity, I think it's become more visible, perhaps, to practitioners and to the taxpayers.
Well, I agree with where Senator Telfer was going. It'd be really nice if we could put an emergency clause on this and get rid of all the ambiguity. But given what we're faced with, I think the best we can probably do is just act as quickly as we can and give the taxpayers a clear signal. Okay, thank you, Deborah. Any other questions before we lose Deborah? Okay, thank you. I think at this point I'll accept an amendment from Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the -2 amendments dated 2811 to Senate Bill 301.
Senator Morris has moved the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 301. Is there any discussion, any further discussion on what we're doing here? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris? Oh, wait. We're going to hold on to this bill. If the amendment is in there now, we're going to hold on to this bill until after the forecast. It does have a revenue impact, and we want to make sure that we are proceeding with our eyes open, as it were. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 301 as amended by the -2 amendment. Is there any other business before the committee? Senator. Doctor.
You've been demoted.
Senator Warner.
Dr. Warner, well, that was kind of a Freudian slip.
Yes. My chance to be Sherman-esque about not serving. Madam Chair and committee, I just wanted to say a couple things about your schedule for this week. One thing, Senate Bill 303, the chair had carried over from Monday, from last Friday. This was a bill from the department. Upon further review, the department decided they don't need that bill. So that one, that's why we didn't post that for today. It's the one on the time limit on the kicker refunds. So that's why we didn't have that bill today. The other thing is tomorrow morning you are invited to attend at 8 o'clock the revenue forecast meeting of the House Revenue Committee in this room. So you're certainly welcome to attend, and we will have a spot for you. And just to remind you of that. And the other thing I wanted to mention is we have posted for no Senate Finance and Revenue Committee meeting on Friday. But you're not quite off the hook, because we are going to schedule an organizational meeting at 9 o'clock on Friday for the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Paul, was so. That 9 or 10? We had talked about 10 at some point. It's going to be at 9?
Yes. No.
I'm double-checking here.
Madam Chair, maybe we had talked about 8.
We never talked seriously about 8.
No.
I was the one who suggested 9.
We're willing to get up at 8 for the forecast, but that's it.
But we'll be posting the organizational meeting for that joint committee here shortly, and have some rules for you to adopt and a work plan to discuss.
redistricting sometime, 10:30, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's going to be short.
Okay.
Okay, anything else for the good of the order, Dr. Warner? All right. Anything else from the committee? We are adjourned.